This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents Behave, The Biology of Humans at Our Best and Worst by Robert M. Sapolsky. Read for you by Michael Goldstrom. To Mel Connor, who taught me. To John Newton, who inspired me. To Lisa, who saved me. Introduction. The fantasy always runs like this. A team of us has fought our way into his secret bunker. Okay, it's a fantasy. Let's go whole hog. I've single-handedly neutralized his elite guard and have burst into his bunker, my Browning machine gun at the ready. He lunges for his Luger. I knock it out of his hand. He lunges for the cyanide pill he keeps to commit suicide rather than be captured. I knock that out of his hand as well. He snarls in rage, attacks with otherworldly strength. We grapple. I manage to gain the upper hand and pin him down and handcuff him. Adolf Hitler, I announce, I arrest you for crimes against humanity. And this is where the Medal of Honor version of the fantasy ends and the imagery darkens. What would I do with Hitler? The viscera becomes so raw that I switch to passive voice in my mind to get some distance. What should be done with Hitler? It's easy to imagine, once I allow myself. Sever his spine at the neck. Leave him paralyzed, but with sensation. Take out his eyes with a blunt instrument. Puncture his eardrums. Rip out his tongue. Keep him alive, tube-fed, on a respirator. Immobile. Unable to speak, to see, to hear. Only able to feel. Then inject him with something that will give him a cancer that festers and pustulates in every corner of his body, that will grow and grow until every one of his cells shrieks with agony, till every moment feels like an infinity spent in the fires of hell. That's what should be done with Hitler. That's what I would want done to Hitler. That's what I would do to Hitler. I've had versions of this fantasy since I was a kid, still do at times, and when I really immerse myself in it, my heart rate quickens, I flush, my fists clench. All those plans for Hitler, the most evil person in history, the soul most deserving of punishment. But there is a big problem. I don't believe in souls or evil, think that the word wicked is most pertinent to a musical, and doubt that punishment should be relevant to criminal justice. But there's a problem with that in turn. I sure feel like some people should be put to death, yet I oppose the death penalty. I've enjoyed plenty of violent, schlocky movies, despite being in favor of strict gun control. And I sure had fun when, at some kid's birthday party and against various unformed principles in my mind, I played laser tag, shooting at strangers from hiding places. Fun, that is, until some pimply kid zapped me like a million times and then snickered at me, which made me feel insecure and unmanly. Yet at the same time, I know most of the lyrics to Down by the Riverside. Ain't gonna study war no more. Plus, when you're supposed to clap your hands. In other words, I have a confused array of feelings and thoughts about violence, aggression, and competition. Just like most humans. To preach from an obvious soapbox, our species has problems with violence. We have the means to create thousands of mushroom clouds. Showerheads and subway ventilation systems have carried poison gas. Letters have carried anthrax. Passenger planes have become weapons. Mass rapes can constitute a military strategy. Bombs go off in markets. School children with guns massacre other children. There are neighborhoods where everyone from pizza delivery guys to firefighters fears for their safety. And there are the subtler versions of violence, say, a childhood of growing up abused, or the effects on a minority people when the symbols of the majority shout domination and menace. We are always shadowed by the threat of other humans harming us. If that were solely the way things are, violence would be an easy problem to approach intellectually. AIDS, unambiguously bad news, eradicate. Alzheimer's disease, same thing. Schizophrenia, cancer, malnutrition, flesh-eating bacteria, global warming, comets hitting Earth, ditto. The problem, though, is that violence doesn't go on that list. Sometimes we have no problem with it at all. This is a central point of this book. We don't hate violence. We hate and fear the wrong kind of violence, violence in the wrong context. Because violence in the right context is different. We pay good money to watch it in a stadium. We teach our kids to fight back. We feel proud when, in creaky middle age, we manage a dirty hip check in a weekend basketball game. Our conversations are filled with military metaphors. We rally the troops after our ideas get shot down. Our sports teams' names celebrate violence. Warriors, Vikings, Lions, Tigers, and Bears. We even think this way about something as cerebral as chess. Kasparov kept pressing for a murderous attack. Toward the end, Kasparov had to oppose threats of violence with more of the same. We build theologies around violence, elect leaders who excel at it, and in the case of so many women, preferentially mate with champions of human combat. When it's the right type of aggression, we love it. It is the ambiguity of violence, that we can pull a trigger as an act of hideous aggression or of self-sacrificing love, that is so challenging. As a result, violence will always be a part of the human experience that is profoundly hard to understand. This book explores the biology of violence, aggression, and competition, the behaviors and the impulses behind them, the acts of individuals, groups, and states, and when these are bad or good things. It is a book about the ways in which humans harm one another. But it is also a book about the ways in which people do the opposite. What does biology teach us about cooperation, affiliation, reconciliation, empathy, and altruism? The book has a number of personal roots. One is that, having had blessedly little personal exposure to violence in my life, the entire phenomenon scares the crap out of me. I think like an academic egghead, believing that if I write enough paragraphs about a scary subject, give enough lectures about it, it will give up and go away quietly. And if everyone took enough classes about the biology of violence and studied hard, we'd all be able to take a nap between the snoozing lion and lamb. Such is the delusional sense of efficacy of a professor. Then there's the other personal route for this book. I am by nature majorly pessimistic. Give me any topic, and I'll find a way in which things will fall apart. Or turn out wonderfully, and somehow, because of that, be poignant and sad. It's a pain in the butt, especially to people stuck around me. And when I had kids, I realized that I needed to get a hold of this tendency big time. So I looked for evidence that things weren't quite that bad. I started small, practicing on them. Don't cry, a T-Rex would never come and eat you. Of course Nemo's daddy will find him. And as I've learned more about the subject of this book, there's been an unexpected realization. The realms of humans harming one another are neither universal nor inevitable, and we're getting some scientific insights into how to avoid them. My pessimistic self has a hard time admitting this, but there is room for optimism. The approach in this book. I make my living as a combination neurobiologist, someone who studies the brain, and primatologist, someone who studies monkeys and apes. Therefore, this is a book that is rooted in science, specifically biology. And out of that come three key points. First, you can't begin to understand things like aggression, competition, cooperation, and empathy without biology. I say this for the benefit of a certain breed of social scientist who finds biology to be irrelevant and a bit ideologically suspect when thinking about human social behavior. But just as important, second, you're just as much up the creek if you rely only on biology. This is said for the benefit of a style of molecular fundamentalist who believes that the social sciences are destined to be consumed by real science. And as a third point, by the time you finish this book, you'll see that it actually makes no sense to distinguish between aspects of a behavior that are biological and those that would be described as, say, psychological or cultural, utterly intertwined. Understanding the biology of these human behaviors is obviously important, but unfortunately, it is hellishly complicated. Now, if you are interested in the biology of, say, how migrating birds navigate, or in the mating reflex that occurs in female hamsters when they're ovulating, this would be an easier task. But that's not what we're interested in. Instead, it's human behavior, human social behavior, and in many cases, abnormal human social behavior. And it is indeed a mess, a subject involving brain chemistry, hormones, sensory cues, prenatal environment, early experience, genes, both biological and cultural evolution, and ecological pressures, among other things. How are we supposed to make sense of all these factors in thinking about behavior? We tend to use a certain cognitive strategy when dealing with complex, multifaceted phenomena in that we break down those separate facets into categories, into buckets of explanation. Suppose there's a rooster standing next to you, and there's a chicken across the street. The rooster gives a sexually solicitive gesture that is hot by chicken standards, and she promptly runs over to mate with him. I haven't a clue if this is how it works, but let's just suppose. And thus we have a key behavioral biological question. Why did the chicken cross the road? And if you're a psychoneuroendocrinologist, your answer would be, because circulating estrogen levels in that chicken worked in a certain part of her brain to make her responsive to this male signaling. And if you're a bioengineer, the answer would be, because the long bone in the leg of the chicken forms a fulcrum for her pelvis, or some such thing, allowing her to move forward rapidly. And if you're an evolutionary biologist, you'd say, because over the course of millions of years, chickens that responded to such gestures at a time that they were fertile left more copies of their genes, and thus this is now an innate behavior in chickens, and so on, thinking in categories in differing scientific disciplines of explanation. The goal of this book is to avoid such categorical thinking. Putting facts into nice, cleanly demarcated buckets of explanation has its advantages. For example, it can help you remember facts better. But it can wreak havoc on your ability to think about those facts. This is because the boundaries between different categories are often arbitrary. But once some arbitrary boundary exists, we forget that it is arbitrary and get way too impressed with its importance. For example, the visual spectrum is a continuum of wavelengths from violet to red, and it is arbitrary where boundaries are put for different color names. For example, where we see a transition from blue to green, as proof of this, different languages arbitrarily split up the visual spectrum at different points in coming up with the words for different colors. Show someone two roughly similar colors. If the color name boundary in that person's language happens to fall between the two colors, the person will overestimate the difference between the two. If the colors fall in the same category, the opposite happens. In other words, when you think categorically, you have trouble seeing how similar or different two things are. If you pay lots of attention to where boundaries are, you pay less attention to complete pictures. Thus, the official intellectual goal of this book is to avoid using categorical buckets when thinking about the biology of some of our most complicated behaviors, even more complicated than chickens crossing roads. What's the replacement? A behavior has just occurred. Why did it happen? Your first category of explanation is going to be a neurobiological one. What went on in that person's brain a second before the behavior happened? Now pull out to a slightly larger field of vision. Your next category of explanation, a little earlier in time. What sight, sound, or smell in the previous seconds to minutes triggered the nervous system to produce that behavior? On to the next explanatory category. What hormones acted hours to days earlier to change how responsive that individual was to the sensory stimuli that trigger the nervous system to produce the behavior? And by now, you've increased your field of vision to be thinking about neurobiology and the sensory world of our environment and short-term endocrinology in trying to explain what happened. And you just keep expanding. What features of the environment in the prior weeks to years changed the structure and function of that person's brain and thus changed how it responded to those hormones and environmental stimuli? Then you go further back to the childhood of the individual, their fetal environment, then their genetic makeup. And then you increase the view to encompass factors larger than that one individual. How has culture shaped the behavior of people living in that individual's group? What ecological factors helped shape that culture? expanding and expanding until considering events umpteen millennia ago and the evolution of that behavior. Okay, so this represents an improvement. It seems like instead of trying to explain all of behavior with a single discipline, e.g., everything can be explained with knowledge about this particular, take your pick, hormone, gene, childhood event, we'll be thinking about a bunch of disciplinary buckets. But something subtler will be done, and this is the most important idea in the book. When you explain a behavior with one of these disciplines, you are implicitly invoking all the disciplines. Any given type of explanation is the end product of the influences that preceded it. It has to work this way. If you say the behavior occurred because of the release of neurochemical Y in the brain, you are also saying the behavior occurred because the heavy secretion of hormone X this morning increased the levels of neurochemical Y. You're also saying the behavior occurred because the environment in which that person was raised made her brain more likely to release neurochemical Y in response to certain types of stimuli. And you're also saying because of the gene that codes for the particular version of neurochemical Y. And if you've so much as whispered the word gene, you're also saying, and because of the millennia of factors that shape the evolution of that particular gene, and so on. There are not different disciplinary buckets. Instead, each one is the end product of all the biological influences that came before it and will influence all the factors that follow it. Thus, it is impossible to conclude that a behavior is caused by a gene, a hormone, a childhood trauma, because the second you invoke one type of explanation, you are de facto invoking them all. No buckets. A neurobiological, or genetic, or developmental explanation for a behavior is just shorthand, an expository convenience for temporarily approaching the whole multifactorial arc from a particular perspective. Pretty impressive, huh? Actually, maybe not. Maybe I'm just pretentiously saying you have to think complexly about complex things. Wow, what a revelation. And maybe what I've been tacitly setting up is this full-of-ourselves straw man of, ooh, we're going to think subtly. We won't get suckered into simplistic answers, not like those chicken-crossing-the-road neurochemists and chicken-evolutionary biologists and chicken-psychoanalysts, all living in their own limited categorical buckets. Obviously, scientists aren't like that. They're smart. They understand that they need to take lots of angles into account. Of necessity, their research may focus on a narrow subject, because there are limits to how much one person can obsess over. But of course they know that their particular categorical bucket isn't the whole story. Maybe yes, maybe no. Consider the following quotes from some card-carrying scientists. The first: give me a dozen healthy infants, well-formed, and my own specified world to bring them up in, and I'll guarantee to take anyone at random and train him to become any type of specialist I might select. Doctor, lawyer, artist, merchant chief, and yes, even beggar man thief, regardless of his talents, pensions, tendencies, abilities, vocations, and race of his ancestors. This was John Watson, a founder of behaviorism, writing around 1925. Behaviorism, with its notion that behavior is completely malleable, that it can be shaped into anything in the right environment, dominated American psychology in the mid-20th century. We'll return to behaviorism and its considerable limitations. The point is that Watson was pathologically caught inside a bucket having to do with the environmental influences on development. I'll guarantee to train him to become any type. Yet we are not all born the same, with the same potential, regardless of how we are trained. The next quote: normal psychic life depends upon the good functioning of brain synapses, and mental disorders appear as a result of synaptic derangements. It is necessary to alter these synaptic adjustments and change the paths chosen by the impulses in their constant passage so as to modify the corresponding ideas and force thought into different channels. Alter synaptic adjustments. Sounds delicate. Yeah, right. These were the words of the Portuguese neurologist Egas Moniz around the time he was awarded the Nobel Prize in 1949 for his development of frontal leucotomies. Here was an individual pathologically stuck in a bucket having to do with a crude version of the nervous system. Just tweak those microscopic synapses with a big ol' ice pick, as was done once leucotomies, later renamed frontal lobotomies, became an assembly line operation. And a final quote. The immensely high reproduction rate in the moral imbecile has long been established. Socially inferior human material is enabled to penetrate and finally to annihilate the healthy nation. The selection for toughness, heroism, social utility must be accomplished by some human institution if mankind, in default of selective factors, is not to be ruined by domestication-induced degeneracy. The racial idea, as the basis of our state, has already accomplished much in this respect. We must, and should, rely on the healthy feelings of our best and charge them with the extermination of elements of the population loaded with dregs. This was Conrad Lorenz, animal behaviorist, Nobel laureate, co-founder of the field of ethology, stay tuned, regular on Nature TV programs. Grandfatherly Conrad, in his Austrian shorts and suspenders, being followed by his imprinted baby geese, was also a rabid Nazi propagandist. Lorenz joined the Nazi Party the instant Austrians were eligible and joined the party's Office of Race Policy, working to psychologically screen Poles of mixed Polish-German parentage, helping to determine which were sufficiently Germanized to be spared death. Here was a man pathologically mired in an imaginary bucket related to gross misinterpretations of what genes do. These were not obscure scientists producing fifth-rate science at Podunk U. These were among the most influential scientists of the 20th century. They helped shape who and how we educate and our views on what social ills are fixable and when we shouldn't bother. They enabled the destruction of the brains of people against their will. And they helped implement final solutions for problems that didn't exist. It can be far more than a mere academic matter when a scientist thinks that human behavior can be entirely explained from only one perspective. Our lives as animals and our human versatility at being aggressive. So we have a first intellectual challenge, which is to always think in this interdisciplinary way. The second challenge is to make sense of humans as apes, primates, mammals. Oh, that's right, we're a kind of animal. And it will be a challenge to figure out when we're just like other animals and when we are utterly different. Some of the time, we are indeed just like any other animal. When we're scared, we secrete the same hormone as would some subordinate fish getting hassled by a bully. The biology of pleasure involves the same brain chemicals in us as in a capybara. Neurons from humans and brine shrimp work the same way. House two female rats together, and over the course of weeks, they will synchronize their reproductive cycles so that they wind up ovulating within a few hours of each other. Try the same with two human females, as reported in some but not all studies, and something similar occurs. It's called the Wellesley effect, first shown with roommates at All Women's Wellesley College. And when it comes to violence, we can be just like some other apes. We pummel, we cudgel, we throw rocks, we kill with our bare hands. So some of the time, an intellectual challenge is to assimilate how similar we can be to other species. In other cases, the challenge is to appreciate how, though human physiology resembles that of other species, we use the physiology in novel ways. We activate the classical physiology of vigilance while watching a scary movie. We activate a stress response when thinking about mortality. We secrete hormones related to nurturing and social bonding, but in response to an adorable baby panda. And this certainly applies to aggression. We use the same muscles as does a male chimp attacking a sexual competitor, but we use them to harm someone because of their ideology. Finally, sometimes the only way to understand our humanness is to consider solely humans because the things we do are unique. While a few other species have regular non-reproductive sex, we're the only ones to talk afterward about how it was. We construct cultures premised on beliefs concerning the nature of life and can transmit those beliefs multi-generationally, even between two individuals separated by millennia. Just consider that perennial bestseller, the Bible. Consonant with that, we can harm by doing things as unprecedented as, and no more physically taxing than, pulling a trigger, or nodding consent, or looking the other way. We can be passive-aggressive, damn with faint praise, cut with scorn, express contempt with patronizing concern. All species are unique, but we are unique in some pretty unique ways. Here are two examples of just how strange and unique humans can be when they go about harming one another and caring for one another. The first example involves, well, my wife. So we're in the minivan, our kids in the back, my wife driving. And this complete jerk cuts us off, almost causing an accident, and in a way that makes it clear that it wasn't distractedness on his part, just sheer selfishness. My wife honks at him, and he flips us off. We're livid, incensed. Asshole, where's the cops when you need them, etc. And suddenly my wife announces that we're going to follow him, make him a little nervous. I'm still furious, but this doesn't strike me as the most prudent thing in the world. Nonetheless, my wife starts trailing him, right on his rear. After a few minutes, the guy's driving evasively, but my wife's on him. Finally, both cars stop at a red light, one that we know is a long one. Another car is stopped in front of the villain. He's not going anywhere. Suddenly, my wife grabs something from the front seat divider, opens her door, and says, "Now he's going to be sorry." I rouse myself feebly. Honey, do you really think this is such a good..." But she's out of the car, starts pounding on his window. I hurry over just in time to hear my wife say, "If you could do something that mean to another person, you probably need this," in a venomous voice. She then flings something in the window. She returns to the car, triumphant, just glorious. "What did you throw in there?" She's not talking yet. The light turns green. There's no one behind us, and we just sit there. The thug's car starts to blink, a very sensible turn indicator, makes a slow turn, and heads down a side street into the dark at, like, 5 miles an hour. If it's possible for a car to look ashamed, this car was doing it. "Honey, what did you throw in there? Tell me." She allows herself a small, malicious grin. "A grape lollipop." I was awed by her savage, passive aggressiveness. "You're such a mean, awful human that something must have gone really wrong in your childhood, and maybe this lollipop will help correct that just a little." That guy was going to think twice before screwing with us again. I swelled with pride and love. And the second example. In the mid-1960s, a rightist military coup overthrew the government of Indonesia, instituting the 30-year dictatorship of Suharto, known as the New Order. Following the coup, government-sponsored purges of communists, leftists, intellectuals, unionists, and ethnic Chinese left about 500,000 dead. Mass executions, torture, villages torched with inhabitants trapped inside. V.S. Naipaul, in his book Among the Believers, An Islamic Journey, describes hearing rumors while in Indonesia that when a paramilitary group would arrive to exterminate every person in some village, they would, incongruously, bring along a traditional gamelan orchestra. Eventually, Naipaul encountered an unrepentant veteran of a massacre, and he asked him about the rumor. "Yes, it is true. We would bring along gamelan musicians, singers, flutes, gongs, the whole shebang." "Why? Why would you possibly do that?" The man looked puzzled and gave what seemed to him a self-evident answer. "Well, to make it more beautiful." Bamboo flutes, burning villages, the lollipop ballistics of maternal love. We have our work cut out for us, trying to understand the virtuosity with which we humans harm or care for one another, and how deeply intertwined the biology of the two can be. Chapter 1. The Behavior. We have our strategy in place. A behavior has occurred, one that is reprehensible or wonderful, or floating ambiguously in between. What occurred in the prior second that triggered the behavior? This is the province of the nervous system. What occurred in the prior seconds to minutes that triggered the nervous system to produce that behavior? This is the world of sensory stimuli, much of it sensed unconsciously. What occurred in the prior hours to days to change the sensitivity of the nervous system to such stimuli? acute actions of hormones, and so on, all the way back to the evolutionary pressures played out over the prior millions of years that started the ball rolling. So we're set. Except that when approaching this big sprawling mess of a subject, it is kind of incumbent upon you to first define your terms, which is an unwelcome prospect. Here are some words of central importance to this book. Aggression, violence, compassion, empathy, sympathy, competition, cooperation, altruism, envy, schadenfreude, spite, forgiveness, reconciliation, revenge, reciprocity, and why not, love. Flinging us into definitional quagmires. Why the difficulty? As emphasized in the introduction, one reason is that so many of these terms are the subject of ideological battles over the appropriation and distortions of their meanings. Words pack power, and these definitions are laden with values, often wildly idiosyncratic ones. Here's an example, namely the ways I think about the word competition. A. Competition. Your lab team races the Cambridge group to a discovery. Exhilarating, but embarrassing to admit to. B. Competition. Playing pickup soccer. Fine, as long as the best player shifts sides if the score becomes lopsided. C. Competition. Your child's teacher announces a prize for the best outlining your fingers Thanksgiving turkey drawing. Silly and perhaps a red flag. If it keeps happening, maybe complain to the principal. D. Competition. Whose deity is more worth killing for? Try to avoid. But the biggest reason for the definitional challenge was emphasized in the introduction. These terms mean different things to scientists living inside different disciplines. Is aggression about thought, emotion, or something done with muscles? Is altruism something that can be studied mathematically in various species, including bacteria? Or are we discussing moral development in kids? And implicit in these different perspectives, disciplines have differing tendencies toward lumping and splitting. These scientists believe that behavior X consists of two different subtypes, whereas those scientists think it comes in 17 flavors. Let's examine this with respect to different types of aggression. Animal behaviorists dichotomize between offensive and defensive aggression, distinguishing between, say, the intruder and the resident of a territory. The biology underlying these two versions differs. Such scientists also distinguish between conspecific aggression, between members of the same species, and fighting off a predator. Meanwhile, criminologists distinguish between impulsive and premeditated aggression. Anthropologists care about differing levels of organization underlying aggression, distinguishing among warfare, clan vendettas, and homicide. Moreover, various disciplines distinguish between aggression that occurs reactively, in response to provocation, and spontaneous aggression, as well as between hot-blooded, emotional aggression, and cold-blooded, instrumental aggression, e.g., I want your spot to build my nest, so scram or I'll peck your eyes out. This isn't personal, though. Then there's another version of this isn't personal. Targeting someone just because they're weak and you're frustrated, stressed, or pained and need to display some aggression. Such third-party aggression is ubiquitous. Shock a rat and it's likely to bite the smaller guy nearby. A beta-ranking male baboon loses a fight to the alpha and he chases the omega male. When unemployment rises, so do rates of domestic violence. Depressingly, as will be discussed in Chapter 4, displacement aggression can decrease the perpetrator's stress hormone levels. Giving ulcers can help you avoid getting them. And of course, there is the ghastly world of aggression that is neither reactive nor instrumental, but is done for pleasure. Then there are specialized subtypes of aggression. Maternal aggression, which often has a distinctive endocrinology. There's the difference between aggression and ritualistic threats of aggression. For example, many primates have lower rates of actual aggression than of ritualized threats, such as displaying their canines. Similarly, aggression in Siamese fighting fish is mostly ritualistic. Getting a definitional handle on the more positive terms isn't easy either. There's empathy versus sympathy, reconciliation versus forgiveness, and altruism versus pathological altruism. For a psychologist, the last term might describe the empathic codependency of enabling a partner's drug use. For a neuroscientist, it describes a consequence of a type of damage to the frontal cortex. In economic games of shifting strategies, individuals with such damage fail to switch to less altruistic play when being repeatedly stabbed in the back by the other player, despite being able to verbalize the other player's strategy. When it comes to the more positive behaviors, the most pervasive issue is one that ultimately transcends semantics. Does pure altruism actually exist? Can you ever separate doing good from the expectation of reciprocity, public acclaim, self-esteem, or the promise of paradise? This plays out in a fascinating realm, as reported in Larissa McFarquhar's 2009 New Yorker piece, The Kindest Cut. It concerns people who donate organs not to family members or close friends, but to strangers. An act of seemingly pure altruism. But these Samaritans unnerve everyone, sowing suspicion and skepticism. Is she expecting to get paid secretly for her kidney? Is she that desperate for attention? Will she work her way into the recipient's life and do a fatal attraction? What's her deal? The piece suggests that these profound acts of goodness unnerve because of their detached, affectless nature. This speaks to an important point that runs through the book. As noted, we distinguish between hot-blooded and cold-blooded violence. We understand the former more, can see mitigating factors in it. Consider the grieving, raging man who kills the killer of his child. And conversely, affectless violence seems horrifying and incomprehensible. This is the sociopathic contract killer, the Hannibal Lecter who kills without his heart rate nudging up a beat. It's why cold-blooded killing is a damning descriptor. Similarly, we expect that our best, most pro-social acts be warm-hearted, filled with positive affect. Cold-blooded goodness seems oxymoronic, is unsettling. I was once at a conference of neuroscientists and all-star Buddhist monk meditators, the former studying what the brains of the latter did during meditation. One scientist asked one of the monks whether he ever stops meditating because his knees hurt from all that cross-leggedness. He answered, "Sometimes I'll stop sooner than I planned, but not because it hurts. It's not something I notice. It's as an act of kindness to my knees." Whoa, I thought, these guys are from another planet. A cool, commendable one, but another planet nonetheless. Crimes of passion and good acts of passion make the most sense to us. Nevertheless, as we shall see, dispassionate kindness often has much to recommend it. Hot-blooded badness, warm-hearted goodness, and the unnerving incongruity of the cold-blooded versions raise a key point, encapsulated in a quote from Elie Wiesel, the Nobel Peace Prize winner and concentration camp survivor. "The opposite of love is not hate. Its opposite is indifference." The biologies of strong love and strong hate are similar in many ways, as we'll see. Which reminds us that we don't hate aggression. We hate the wrong kind of aggression, but love it in the right context. And conversely, in the wrong context, our most laudable behaviors are anything but. The motoric features of our behaviors are less important and challenging to understand than the meaning behind our muscles' actions. This is shown in a subtle study. Subjects in a brain scanner entered a virtual room where they encountered either an injured person in need of help or a menacing extraterrestrial. Subjects could either bandage or shoot the individual. Pulling a trigger and applying a bandage are different behaviors. But they are similar insofar as bandaging the injured person and shooting the alien are both the right things. And contemplating those two different versions of doing the right thing activated the same circuitry in the most context-savvy part of the brain, the prefrontal cortex. And thus those key terms that anchor this book are most difficult to define because of their profound context dependency. I will therefore group them in a way that reflects this. I won't frame the behaviors to come as either pro or antisocial, too cold-blooded for my expository tastes. Nor will they be labeled as good and evil, too hot-blooded and frothy. Instead, as our convenient shorthand for concepts that truly defy brevity, this book is about the biology of our best and worst behaviors. Chapter 2. 1 second before. Various muscles have moved and a behavior has happened. Perhaps it is a good act. You've empathically touched the arm of a suffering person. Perhaps it is a foul act. You've pulled a trigger, targeting an innocent person. Perhaps it is a good act. You've pulled a trigger, drawing fire to save others. Perhaps it is a foul act. You've touched the arm of someone, starting a chain of libidinal events that betray a loved one. Acts that, as emphasized, are definable only by context. Thus, to ask the question that will begin this and the next 8 chapters, why did that behavior occur? As this book's starting point, we know that different disciplines produce different answers, because of some hormone, because of evolution, because of childhood experiences or genes or culture. And as the book's central premise, these are utterly intertwined answers, none standing alone. But on the most proximal level, in this chapter we ask, what happened 1 second before the behavior that caused it to occur? This puts us in the realm of neurobiology, of understanding the brain that commanded those muscles. This chapter is one of the book's anchors. The brain is the final common pathway, the conduit that mediates the influences of all the distal factors to be covered in the chapters to come. What happened an hour, a decade, a million years earlier? What happened were factors that impacted the brain and the behavior it produced. This chapter has 2 major challenges. The first is its god-awful length. Apologies. I've tried to be succinct and non-technical, but this is foundational material that needs to be covered. Second, regardless of how non-technical I've tried to be, the material can overwhelm someone with no background in neuroscience. Now we ask, what crucial things happened in the second before that pro- or antisocial behavior occurred? Or, translated into neurobiology, what was going on with action potentials, neurotransmitters, and neural circuits in particular brain regions during that second? 3 metaphorical, but not literal, layers. We start by considering the brain's macro-organization, using a model proposed in the 1960s by the neuroscientist Paul MacLean. His triune brain model conceptualizes the brain as having 3 functional domains. Layer 1. An ancient part of the brain, at its base, found in species from humans to geckos. This layer mediates automatic, regulatory functions. If body temperature drops, this brain region senses it and commands muscles to shiver. If blood glucose levels plummet, that's sensed here, generating hunger. If an injury occurs, a different loop initiates a stress response. Layer 2. A more recently evolved region that has expanded in mammals. MacLean conceptualized this layer as being about emotions, somewhat of a mammalian invention. If you see something gruesome and terrifying, this layer sends commands down to ancient layer 1, making you shiver with emotion. If you're feeling sadly unloved, regions here prompt layer 1 to generate a craving for comfort food. If you're a rodent and smell a cat, neurons here cause layer 1 to initiate a stress response. Layer 3. The recently evolved layer of neocortex sitting on the upper surface of the brain. Proportionately, primates devote more of their brain to this layer than do other species. Cognition, memory storage, sensory processing, abstractions, philosophy, naval contemplation. Read a scary passage of a book, and layer 3 signals layer 2 to make you feel frightened, prompting layer 1 to initiate shivering. See an ad for Oreos and feel a craving. Layer 3 influences layer 2 and 1. Contemplate the fact that loved ones won't live forever, or kids in refugee camps, or how the Navi's home tree was destroyed by those jerk humans in Avatar, despite the fact that, wait, Navi aren't real. and layer 3 pulls layers 2 and 1 into the picture, and you feel sad and have the same sort of stress response that you'd have if you were fleeing a lion. Thus, we've got the brain divided into 3 functional buckets, with the usual advantages and disadvantages of categorizing a continuum. The biggest disadvantage is how simplistic this is. For example, A, anatomically there is considerable overlap among the 3 layers. For example, one part of the cortex can best be thought of as part of layer 2. Stay tuned. B, the flow of information and commands is not just top-down, from layer 3 to 2 to 1. A weird, great example explored in chapter 15. If someone is holding a cold drink, temperature is processed in layer 1, they're more likely to judge someone they meet as having a cold personality, layer 3. C, automatic aspects of behavior, simplistically the purview of layer 1, emotion, layer 2, and thought, layer 3, are not separable. D. The triune model leads one, erroneously, to think that evolution in effect slapped on each new layer without any changes occurring in the ones already there. Despite these drawbacks, which MacLean himself emphasized, this model will be a good organizing metaphor for us. The limbic system. To make sense of our best and worst behaviors, automaticity, emotion, and cognition must all be considered. I arbitrarily start with layer 2 and its emphasis on emotion. Early 20th century neuroscientists thought it obvious what layer 2 did. Take your standard issue lab animal, a rat, and examine its brain. Right at the front would be these 2 gigantic lobes, the olfactory bulbs, one for each nostril, the primary receptive area for odors. Neuroscientists at the time asked what parts of the brain these gigantic rodent olfactory bulbs talked to, i.e. where they sent their axonal projections, which brain regions were only a single synapse away from receiving olfactory information, which were 2 synapses, 3, and so on. And it was layer 2 structures that received the first communiques. Ah, everyone concluded, this part of the brain must process odors. And so it was termed the rhinencephalon, the nose brain. Meanwhile, in the 30s and 40s, neuroscientists such as the young MacLean, James Pappes, Paul Bussy, and Heinrich Kluver were starting to figure out what the layer 2 structures did. For example, if you lesion, i.e. destroy, layer 2 structures, this produces Kluver-Bussy syndrome, featuring abnormalities in sociality, especially in sexual and aggressive behaviors. They concluded that these structures, soon termed the limbic system, for obscure reasons, were about emotion. Rhinencephalon, or limbic system? Olfaction, or emotion? Pitched street battles ensued until someone pointed out the obvious. For a rat, emotion and olfaction are nearly synonymous, since nearly all the environmental stimuli that elicit emotions in a rodent are olfactory. Peace in our time. In a rodent, olfactory inputs are what the limbic system most depends on for emotional news of the world. In contrast, the primate limbic system is more informed by visual inputs. Limbic function is now recognized as central to the emotions that fuel our best and worst behaviors, and extensive research has uncovered the functions of its structures, e.g. the amygdala, hippocampus, septum, habenula, and mammillary bodies. There aren't really centers in the brain for particular behaviors. This is particularly the case with the limbic system and emotion. There is indeed a sub-subregion of the motor cortex that approximates being the center for making your left pinky bend. Other regions have center-ish roles in regulating breathing or body temperature, but there sure aren't centers for feeling pissy or horny, for feeling bittersweet nostalgia or warm protectiveness tinged with contempt, or for what is that thing called love feeling. No surprise, then, that the circuitry connecting various limbic structures is immensely complex. The autonomic nervous system and the ancient core regions of the brain. The limbic system's regions form complex circuits of excitation and inhibition. It's easier to understand this by appreciating the deeply held desire of every limbic structure to influence what the hypothalamus does. Why? Because of its importance. The hypothalamus, a limbic structure, is the interface between layers 1 and 2, between core regulatory and emotional parts of the brain. Consistent with that, the hypothalamus gets massive inputs from limbic layer 2 structures, but disproportionately sends projections to layer 1 regions. These are the evolutionarily ancient midbrain and brainstem, which regulate automatic reactions throughout the body. For a reptile, such automatic regulation is straightforward. If muscles are working hard, this is sensed by neurons throughout the body that send signals up the spine to layer 1 regions, resulting in signals back down the spine that increase heart rate and blood pressure. The result is more oxygen and glucose for the muscles. Gorge on food, and stomach walls distend. Neurons embedded there sense this and pass on the news, and soon blood vessels in the gut dilate, increasing blood flow and facilitating digestion. Too warm? Blood is sent to the body's surface to dissipate heat. All of this is automatic, or autonomic, and thus the midbrain and brain stem regions, along with their projections down the spine and out to the body, are collectively termed the autonomic nervous system. Footnote. It is also often called the involuntary nervous system, contrasting it with the voluntary nervous system. The latter is about conscious, voluntary movement and involves neurons in motor regions of the brain and their projections down the spine to skeletal muscles. And where does the hypothalamus come in? It's the means by which the limbic system influences autonomic function. How layer 2 talks to layer 1. Have a full bladder with its muscle walls distended, and midbrain / brainstem circuitry votes for urinating. Be exposed to something sufficiently terrifying, and limbic structures, via the hypothalamus, persuade the midbrain and brainstem to do the same. This is how emotions change bodily functions. Why limbic roads eventually lead to the hypothalamus. Footnote. Just as a warning of complexities to come, the hypothalamus consists of a bunch of different nuclei, each receiving a unique orchestration of limbic inputs and equivalently distinctive outputs to various midbrain / brainstem regions. And while each hypothalamic nucleus has a different set of functions, they all fall under the general rubric of autonomic regulation. The autonomic nervous system has two parts, the sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous system, with fairly opposite functions. The sympathetic nervous system, SNS, mediates the body's response to arousing circumstances, for example, producing the famed fight-or-flight stress response. To use the feeble joke told to first-year medical students, the SNS mediates the four Fs, fear, fight, flight, and sex. Particular midbrain / brainstem nuclei send long SNS projections down the spine and on to outposts throughout the body, where the axon terminals release the neurotransmitter norepinephrine. There's one exception that makes the SNS more familiar. In the adrenal gland, instead of norepinephrine, aka noradrenaline, being released, it's epinephrine, aka the famous adrenaline. Meanwhile, the parasympathetic nervous system, PNS, arises from different midbrain / brainstem nuclei that project down the spine to the body. In contrast to the SNS and the four Fs, the PNS is about calm vegetative states. The SNS speeds up the heart. The PNS slows it down. The PNS promotes digestion. The SNS inhibits it, which makes sense. If you're running for your life, avoiding being someone's lunch, don't waste energy digesting breakfast. And as we will see in chapter 14, if seeing someone in pain activates your SNS, you're likely to be preoccupied with your own distress instead of helping. Turn on the PNS, and it's the opposite. Given that the SNS and PNS do opposite things, the PNS is obviously going to be releasing a different neurotransmitter from its axon terminals. Acetylcholine. Footnote. Like the SNS, the PNS gets the brain to target organs via two steps. And as one complication, the SNS and PNS branches aren't always working in complete opposition. In some cases, they function in a more cooperative, sequential manner. For example, erection and ejaculation involve coordination between the SNS and PNS that is so complicated that it's a miracle that any of us were conceived. There is a second, equally important way in which emotion influences the body. Specifically, the hypothalamus also regulates the release of many hormones. This is covered in Chapter 4. So the limbic system indirectly regulates autonomic function and hormone release. What does this have to do with behavior? Plenty. Because the autonomic and hormonal states of the body feed back to the brain, influencing behavior, typically unconsciously. Stay tuned for more in Chapters 3 and 4. The interface between the limbic system and the cortex. Time to add the cortex. As noted, this is the brain's upper surface. Its name comes from the Latin cortic, meaning tree bark, and is the newest part of the brain. The cortex is the gleaming, logical, analytical crown jewel of layer 3. Most sensory information flows there to be decoded. It's where muscles are commanded to move, where language is comprehended and produced, where memories are stored, where spatial and mathematical skills reside, where executive decisions are made. It floats above the limbic system, supporting philosophers since at least Descartes, who have emphasized the dichotomy between thought and emotion. Of course, that's all wrong, as shown by the temperature of a cup, something processed in the hypothalamus, altering assessment of the coldness of someone's personality. Emotions filter the nature and accuracy of what is remembered. Stroke damage to certain cortical regions blocks the ability to speak. Some sufferers reroute the cerebral world of speech through emotive, limbic detours. They can sing what they want to say. The cortex and limbic system are not separate, as scads of axonal projections course between the two. Crucially, those projections are bidirectional. The limbic system talks to the cortex rather than merely being reined in by it. The false dichotomy between thought and feeling is presented in the classic Descartes' Error by the neurologist Antonio Damasio of the University of Southern California. His work is discussed later. While the hypothalamus dwells at the interface of layers 1 and 2, it is the incredibly interesting frontal cortex that is the interface between layers 2 and 3. Key insight into the frontal cortex was provided in the 1960s by a giant of neuroscience, Vale Nauta of MIT. Nauta studied what brain regions sent axons to the frontal cortex and what regions got axons from it. And the frontal cortex was bidirectionally enmeshed with the limbic system, leading him to propose that the frontal cortex is a quasi-member of the limbic system. Naturally, everyone thought him daft. The frontal cortex was the most recently evolved part of the very highbrow cortex. The only reason why the frontal cortex would ever go slumming into the limbic system would be to preach honest labor and Christian temperance to the urchins there. Naturally, Nauta was right. In different circumstances, the frontal cortex and limbic system stimulate or inhibit each other, collaborate and coordinate, or bicker and work at cross purposes. It really is an honorary member of the limbic system, and the interactions between the frontal cortex and other limbic structures are at the core of much of this book. Two more details. First, the cortex is not a smooth surface, but instead is folded into convolutions. The convolutions form a superstructure of four separate lobes, the temporal, parietal, occipital, and frontal, each with different functions. Second, brains obviously have left and right sides, or hemispheres, that roughly mirror each other. Examples of brain lateralization. Left, analytical thought. Right, intuitive thought. Left, detail-oriented perception. Right, holistic perception. Left, ordered sequencing. Right, random sequencing. Left, rational thought. Right, emotional thought. Left. Verbal. Right. Nonverbal. Left. Cautious. Right. Adventurous. Left. Planning. Right. Impulse. Left. Math/science. Right. Creative writing/art. Left. Logic. Right. Imagination. Left. Right field vision. Right. Left field vision. Left. Right side motor skills. Right. Left side motor skills. Thus, except for the relatively few midline structures, brain regions come in pairs. A left and right amygdala, hippocampus, temporal lobe, and so on. Functions are often lateralized, such that the left and right hippocampi, for example, have different but related functions. The greatest lateralization occurs in the cortex. The left hemisphere is analytical, the right more involved in intuition and creativity. These contrasts have caught the public fancy, with cortical lateralization exaggerated by many to an absurd extent, where left-brainedness has the connotation of anal retentive bean counting and right-brainedness is about making mandalas or singing with whales. In fact, the functional differences between the hemispheres are generally subtle, and I'm mostly ignoring lateralization. We're now ready to examine the brain regions most central to this book, namely the amygdala, the frontal cortex, and the mesolimbic-mesocortical dopamine system. Discussion of other bit player regions will be subsumed under the headings for these three. We start with the one arguably most central to our worst behaviors. The amygdala. The amygdala is the archetypal limbic structure, sitting under the cortex in the temporal lobe. It is central to mediating aggression, along with other behaviors that tell us tons about aggression. A first pass at the amygdala and aggression. The evidence for the amygdala's role in aggression is extensive, based on research approaches that will become familiar. First, there's the correlative recording approach. Stick recording electrodes into numerous species amygdalae and see when neurons there have action potentials. This turns out to be when the animal is being aggressive. In a related approach, determine which brain regions consume extra oxygen or glucose, or synthesize certain activity-related proteins during aggression. The amygdala tops the list. Moving beyond mere correlation, if you lesion the amygdala in an animal, rates of aggression decline. The same occurs transiently when you temporarily silence the amygdala by injecting Novocaine into it. Conversely, implanting electrodes that stimulate neurons there or spritzing in excitatory neurotransmitters, stay tuned, triggers aggression. Show human subjects pictures that provoke anger and the amygdala activates, as shown with neuroimaging. Sticking an electrode in someone's amygdala and stimulating it, as is done before certain types of neurosurgery, produces rage. The most convincing data concern rare humans with damage restricted to the amygdala, either due to a type of encephalitis or a congenital disorder called Wernicke-Vita disease, or where the amygdala was surgically destroyed to control severe drug-resistant seizures originating there. Such individuals are impaired in detecting angry facial expressions while being fine at recognizing other emotional states. Stay tuned. And what does amygdala damage do to aggressive behavior? This was studied in humans where amygdalotomies were done not to control seizures, but to control aggression. Such psychosurgery provoked fiery controversy in the 1970s, and I don't mean scientists not saying hello to each other at conferences. I mean a major public shitstorm. The issue raised bioethical lightning rods. What counted as pathological aggression? Who decided? What other interventions had been tried unsuccessfully? Were some types of hyper-aggressive individuals more likely to go under the knife than others? What constituted a cure? Most of these cases concerned rare epileptics, where seizure onset was associated with uncontrollable aggression, and where the goal was to contain that behavior. These papers had titles such as Clinical and Physiological Effects of Stereotaxic Bilateral Amygdalotomy for Intractable Aggression. The fecal hurricane concerned the involuntary lopping out of the amygdala in people without epilepsy, but with a history of severe aggression. Well, doing this could be profoundly helpful. Or Orwellian. This is a long, dark story, and I will save it for another time. Did destruction of the human amygdala lessen aggression? Pretty clearly so, when violence was a reflexive, inchoate outburst preceding a seizure. But with surgery done solely to control behavior, the answer is, maybe. The heterogeneity of patients and surgical approaches, the lack of modern neuroimaging to pinpoint exactly which parts of the amygdala were destroyed in each individual, and the imprecision in the behavioral data, with papers reporting from 33 to 100% success rates, make things inconclusive. The procedure has almost entirely fallen out of practice. The amygdala aggression link pops up in two notorious cases of violence. The first concerns Ulrike Meinhof, a founder in 1968 of the Red Army faction, a.k.a. the Baader-Meinhof gang, a terrorist group responsible for bombings and bank robberies in West Germany. Meinhof had a conventional earlier life as a journalist,